Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Play Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 34 of Nerd Pride Radio. 34, the saddest rule of the internet. So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones, and I am a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, gaming nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd. Plus, there's about seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my skull anymore. Our sponsor this week, Doofenshmirtz Evil Incorporated.
Doofenshmirtz Evil Incorporated.
Because I cannot get enough of that show. I can't tell you how much I love Phineas and Ferb. It's on instant watch. My kids watch it every day. I watch it with them. I love that show. Great stuff. Anyway, we're going to get straight into the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list, and then the best stuff from that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. And what's up first on the master list? The Unnamed History Segment.
Don't know much about history.
And this week in history, I am talking about the Cloaca Maxima. You know what that is? Yeah, that's Latin for the big drain. Okay. Underneath Rome is what is known as the Cloaca Maxima, probably the longest existing sewer system still running ever. The thing was originally built, 2,500 years ago, and they still use it as part of their sewer system in Rome today. This thing is incredible. And here's the deal. Nobody knows what's in it. I mean, they go down there. They go down there with their dry suits and their gas masks and their scuba gear, and people have explored. But there are so many branches and tunnels and things underneath Rome that they've barely mapped out maybe 10% of this thing. All right, we don't know where it goes. We don't know where it all comes from. We don't know anything. All right, this is the coolest thing. In a question that I posed on the website, I had said, "What place would you like to visit? Where would you like to go in this world? What country do you want to see before you die?" And one of my answers was Italy. I want to see the underbelly of Italy. I want to go below the city and see everything that's there. Because, all right, first, you know my fascination with tunnels and dungeons and dark places and enclosed spaces, and I'm just a nut for it, all right? And beneath Rome is probably the most fascinating layers of history. All right, for example, I'm babbling on. Let me give you a good example of this. All right. If you happen to be in Rome, go to the San Clemente Basilica. All right. It's in Rome. It's actually near the Colosseum. Sucker was built in the 12th century. All right. So it is already 900 years old now. All right. Now, once you're there, go downstairs. All right. You're in the basement level of the San Clemente Basilica. All right. What you're actually standing in is now the original 4th century San Clemente Basilica. All right, this sucker was condemned in like the year 1100, condemned, filled in with dirt, everything pushed over, and then they built the new basilica on top of it. All right, but now someone's gone down and excavated it because this is what they do in Rome. All right, they've excavated the original basilica, and it's now the basement level of the new one, which is, again, already 900 years old. You now have the 1,600-year-old basement underneath it. All right. But then, once you're done exploring that, go down the stairs again. All right? Now, you're in a first-century apartment building, because that's the building that the original San Clemente was built on. And then, wait, we're not done. Go downstairs from that, because they've excavated even deeper. And you know what you're looking at? Yeah, you're standing in these rooms from some huge public building that was destroyed in the Great Fire of Nero's day. Okay? The Great Fire when Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Yeah. All right, that was this one. All right, and then that sucker, the ruins of it, got filled in, built over, and then those got filled in and built over. Apparently, Rome does this constantly, all right? Because Rome is built on a huge floodplain, or originally, huge floodplain. And what happened was, well, they would build their protective walls, they would build the city up a little higher, and yet still, you know, when the floods come, they're still getting water everywhere, right? Still washing out, still. All right, so when they had wreckage there, they would just basically cover everything over, build up another level, and they'd raise their streets, their buildings, everything, raise up 6-7 feet at a shot, all right, sometimes even more than that. Until now, on average, Rome is 45 feet deep worth of ruins. How unbelievable is that? How badly do you want to go there? I mean, seriously, did you know that if you want to build pretty much anything in or around Rome, anywhere, you are required to get an official government archaeological survey to make sure that you're not running into destroying something of value. And guess what? Everywhere you go, there's something of value. It is absolutely commonplace for the tractors and bulldozers and everything else. They're digging out a new spot for whatever building they're putting up. And as we're digging, we are shoveling up ruins of ancient times. All right. And they have to have official archaeologists on site while they're digging. And so, okay, thing pulls out a scoop of dirt. And oh, wait, hold on. Stop. All right, now all the machines have to stop. Oh, look, we've got shards of something in here. All right, hold on. And at a glance, they go through. They take a few seconds. And, nope, nothing valuable. It's just old floor tiles. Yeah, keep it going. We don't care about any of that crap. All right, and then they'll keep going. And they have to stop another 5 feet. Wait. Oh, no. Okay, you can keep digging. Go. And then, oh, no. Guess what? We hit something valuable. Ah, work's got to shut down for a half a day. No, we need a whole team in here. We got to have to clear all this out. Got to tag it, stick it in a box, throw it in that warehouse where they keep the Ark of the Covenant. This is every single day if you're building something in Rome. This is how they do it. To the point where a lot of people, they keep their hidden history hidden. All right? They honestly, because they know the minute they say something, some government team's going to be coming in, tearing up their floors, digging out what's there, preserving everything. Oh, supposedly they're going to put it all back together when we're done, but you never know. I read a whole bunch of articles on this. I just couldn't stop myself. I got into Wikipedia, and I wound up linking to a whole bunch of stuff, fell down the rabbit hole like I usually do. And one of the quotes that I remember, and I don't know who said it because I should have wrote this down, but one of the guys being interviewed says, yeah, you know, no one wants the Bene Culturale knocking on their door. Bene Culturale would be the official government agency that deals with all of this stuff. So a lot of people, yeah, they keep it hidden. They know the stuff's down there. They've got tunnels and tombs and old temples and apartment buildings and God knows what else right underneath their floors. They know about it. They'll even bring, you know, family guests, visitors. They'll show them around. But, oh, for God's sake, just don't tell anybody. That's the last thing we need, okay? And so, you know, as you're looking at taking tours in Rome, there are lots of companies that offer underground tours of Rome, that they'll take you beneath this and that. They'll show you, the beginnings of the sewers. They'll show you. But, you know, you can only go so far as an official tour can take you. But the guy writing this article about tours is saying that, well, yeah, but keep in mind, there's a bunch of people with hidden stuff, and they kind of have a network there, a hidden network of people who all have hidden history right underneath their feet, right underneath their houses. And so he says, you know, if you can get in touch with any of them, you kind of ask around a little bit, as long as you're not going to say anything, yeah, there's lots of people who are willing to take you down there and show you what they've got. Kind of cool. Okay, here's another good one. You've heard that the Colosseum, when it was originally built, the Colosseum would at times be flooded, all right, and they would fill the bottom of the Colosseum with water, and then they would bring ships in, and they would act out naval battles for the benefit of the audience. All right. It was always that story. People always said that, but there was no proof of it. All right, and for hundreds of years, people, historians, archaeologists would tell people, no, no, that's just a myth. They always said that. But if you look underneath the Colosseum, there is no construction for bringing in that volume of water. That would require huge amounts of water to be brought in. Clearly, that never actually happened until someone went below that even. All right, they dug out even further down underneath the Colosseum, and they found conduits for fresh water to be brought in, conduits that apparently had been built for Nero. Again, Nero, who let Rome burn. Conduits had been built for Nero to charge a private garden lake on his estate. How? All right, just think about that. All right, the guy who can build something that huge just so he can have his own private lake, right? All right, well, those things run right underneath the Colosseum, and once they found them, they went, oh, yeah, you know what? Nero wasn't using them anymore. There's no reason they couldn't have diverted this water. I'm sure that's exactly what they did. All right, and they figured that out in 2003. That's how long it took them to figure out that, oh, yeah, guess what? They really didn't reenact naval battles here. Oh, my God. Go figure. And that's, I just, God, there's so many things. It's not even the full extent of what's under there. There's also the catacombs of Rome, all right? The catacombs are there were some Jewish catacombs originally, but primarily the catacombs that you're going to find in Rome are all Christian. During the early days of Christianity, even after it became an official religion for a little bit, they had about 200-300 years, back around the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, they had a time where the common Roman practice had always been to cremate dead bodies and then do whatever you're going to do. The ashes, I think they actually kept them and had little memorials and whatever for them. But Christians had a real problem with the burning because, well, of course, you know, it says right there in the Bible that we're going to be brought bodily back to earth, that we're going to be reunited with our bodies when the rapture comes. And so, therefore, they were a little hinky about burning them up. So Christians wanted to have burials. Well, there's no good place for a burial in Rome. So what'd they do? They dug underneath Rome. They dug out the catacombs because they had this really soft rock that was actually really good for this. And they had these long strings of tunnels with all these side tunnels, and they dig little niches into the wall. Now, here's the thing that I don't get, though, to go off on a little bit of a tangent. So you go into the catacombs, you find a space near some cool martyr, you dig yourself out a little niche, you put your loved one in there, you fold him up with his shroud and his personal belongings, and then you seal that sucker up with a big old slab of stone, and now he is sealed into the wall. And I'm thinking to myself, how is that any better when the rapture comes? How horrible to be reunited with your body at this point. I mean, assuming that, you know, not like we didn't know about decay at that point, right? I mean, they know that most of the people, their bodies are going to be bones and very little else by the time the rapture comes around. So I don't know what good they thought they were going to do. But even worse, now they're just going to be bones sealed behind a giant slab. I honestly, that would seem a lot more horrible than coming back to the ashes, wouldn't it? I mean, it just seemed a little odd that this is their whole justification for why they bury their dead, and yet, you know, it's not like we're putting the bodies in any usable spot. It just seems weird. But then, you know, I'm not a third century Christian, so I guess there's probably more to it than that. But anyway, there's all these catacombs down there, and so I tried like crazy to come up with maps of the Roman catacombs. That's all I wanted. And what you get is these big maps showing, I mean, it's a huge area that these things are. There's like 40 sets of catacombs in and around Rome, and some of them are unbelievably long. They go on for forever. All right, but all the maps show these big, long passageways with all these branches off of them, and they don't show where the branches go. That we don't know where the branches go. They're just not. And you know why we don't know? Because the church owns all of them. And for the most part, when you go down to the catacombs, what you're going to get is lots of bodies, lots of inscriptions, and lots of early Christian artwork. And that's about it. And the church has basically said, look, we have enough of that. It's not like we need to do a whole lot more research on this. It's not worth desecrating the tombs of these peoples in order to satisfy some further curiosity. And so for the most part, you don't get to go digging around down there. We don't know where all the rest of it goes. There's so much hidden beneath Rome that it just boggles my head. It really, really does. Okay, again, I feel like I'm not being really coherent, but let me give you a couple of last things to go out on here. All right, one, the very first article I encountered on this was from a National Geographic, and I was actually in the waiting room of a hospital. My wife was having a procedure done, and I can't even remember what we were there for, but I remember this magazine, and it was a description of going down into the Cloaca Maxima. All right, and this reporter is there with some professional archaeologist, and they drop down on ropes. They have to climb down. They put on these suits, and they're exploring in waist-deep, chest-high, sometimes sewage. And they're exploring in waist-deep, chest-high sewage, all right? And it's the kind of thing where, you know, the water is this greenish, grayish. You know, for God's sake, whatever you do, don't touch it. Don't let any get on your skin. I mean, they're warning the reporter about this. There's ventings of gases and these foul odors. And it's like, no, time to put the gas masks on. We're done. All right. He said at one point there's this little edge where he's looking at a shattered piece of pottery, a wine jug, water jug, something like that, but a shattered piece of pottery that the archaeologist identifies as, yeah, probably about 1600 years old. And then right next to it is a broken glass water bottle, modern, like I don't know the brand, but like Perrier or something that you would recognize, okay? Here it is, 1600 years old piece of history right next to, you know, the equivalent of a Mountain Dew can, all right? And it's just all over. It's just strewn together like that because God knows where all this comes from. God knows where it all empties out. But here it is all mixed together in one place. The last thing, very last thing, and I promise I'll move on. All right, remember San Clemente? All right, remember? You go down from the 900-year-old basilica into the 1600-year-old basilica into the 2000-year-old apartment buildings into the 2500-year-old government buildings below that. Okay, get down to all of that, and that's where they've stopped excavating. That's where they've stopped cleaning out. But the stone walls on the one side, they've traced those down, and guess what? Those suckers, those walls... from the 2,500-year-old government building, those walls actually go down at least another 20 feet that they can determine. I'm just baffled. They have so much history that there will never be enough time to explore all of it because we keep building more of it. It just goes forever. I dream of being able to walk in these places someday. Just amazing. Now for a shorter segment, we're going to take a little visit to my gaming table.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, I'm going to share it with you. I wasn't going to do a gaming table this week. I really wasn't. I keep, every week, I babble on about gaming with my kids, and this is not going to be any different. So, you know, if you need to fast forward, go right ahead. But last week, I told you that I felt like I was in a rut with my Goblins game. And at the time, I said I thought that my solution to this was to give my son more power, build him up like some kind of anime character, give him power, give him abilities, let him grow and feel what it's like to be that badass, all right? And it turns out I was completely wrong. I'm an idiot. We got together for some gaming a couple of times this week, and I kept it with the low power, low magic, gritty scenario. I didn't add any new powers, abilities, magic items, any of that garbage that I said I was going to do. And instead, what I did, I had this epiphany. Just as we sat down to play, I realized that what he wants, this is my third son, Logue, my 9-year-old, what he wants is narrative control. That's what he's always arguing with me about. I told you guys that last week. He wants to be in control of these scenarios. And so I gave him, I went old school. I went completely classic and tropey. I didn't do anything. I mean, this is stuff that, you know, I've gamed out a million times, but they have someplace they need to go. So this is going to be the travel encounter. You always get one travel encounter wherever you're going. And for this travel encounter, they are going through the mountains. They need to get through this pass, this mountain pass. And we had a social encounter ahead of time. They wound up, it's my son and his group of like 9 or 10 bird people, crow people. And they're mostly children, elderly, wounded, so they're refugees. And they're leaving their homeland and they're trying to find this new safe place. And so they wind up running across a group of kobolds who are also refugees driven out by the Goblin War. And they're headed in the opposite direction because they're warning them that, oh, God, the pass is closed. No, you're never going to get through. We want to go the same way, but now we're going to have to go around, and it's going to take days, and we don't know how we're going to make it. And so my son sits down with them, and they're like, well, we should join forces, at least temporarily. Look, the pass is guarded, apparently, according to the kobolds, the pass is guarded by mountain trolls. And therefore, the trolls are exacting tolls for anyone who wants to cross, and clearly refugees have no money, no goods, no anything to pay tolls with, and so therefore the trolls are going to take it out on your hides. They'll at least make a meal out of you if they can't get any money from you. And so the kobolds have given up. But my son says, no, look, if we work together, I think we can take them. So this is, like I say, this is standard. This is cliche. This is, you know, we need to get through the mountains. We've got trolls guarding the pass. We have to beat the trolls. That's all it is. And so I let him work out all the details. But he's working with the kobolds. He's working with his own people. And I'm basically just, I'm playing out all the other roles, but giving him what he's looking for. And he wants to set up an ambush. He picks the sneakiest person on the team, a little kid, all right? But a fighter all the same, grown up before his time. And this kid is incredibly sneaky. He'll be able to get through. So he's like, all right, you're going to go around behind him. All right, you prepare to ambush him from the rear, set up a trap if you need to. All right, and then who do we have for flyers? All right, the flyers are going to go out and scout the place first. And then we've got two people who can fly. They're old, but they can still carry a crossbow. And so he's like, all right, good. Then we'll put our warriors here. We'll keep all our sick and wounded out of the way at the back. And the people who can still hold a spear, you guys will stay up front. So we'll lead the charge, and once we get them up, you know, it's this narrow little road, so we'll have the crossbowmen are firing down from the top, the guy will sneak up from behind him. Hopefully, we can just shove them over the edge, and we'll be done with them. And that's what he wanted. He wanted to plot out an ambush. He wanted to determine how things were going to go, and you know what? He got up there, and his one downfall is when things don't go the way he's expecting, he gets really frustrated with the game. And fortunately for him, he had some really good dice rolls, and it worked, and they took the trolls down, which, by the way, I've told you, everyone in Goblins is all tiny people, all right? So they're only, you know, everybody involved here is only about 2 foot tall. The trolls, which you can't see me making air quotes, but I am, the trolls are actually just 3 mountain dwarves. But, you know, to these guys, they look like giants, all right? So the 3 trolls are up there guarding the pass. They come up, they make their charge, they get some good rolls. And here's the other thing that I did do. I will give you this one. I also decided that this time I was going to try a new combat system. It's kind of just built out of what we've already been doing. But rather than playing everything out blow by blow, keeping track of damage, keeping track of conditions and all of this, we're going to summarize combat and do it. Grand total, I think combat came down to about 3 rolls, 4 rolls. And pretty much he rolled all the dice. And, well, no, I rolled some opposition as well. But the idea was, I'm calling it advantage combat, that you start off and at first everybody gets a roll, lots of things happen all at once, but after this first set of rolls comes out and you compare numbers and you decide who wins and who doesn't, you decide that, okay, this side came out ahead, this side has advantage, all right? And if you can get advantage 2 or 3 times, that means you've pretty much won and you can narrate how you want this sucker to end. And so they came out with advantage, so now they've got the high ground. The trolls are drunk and off guard, so they roll again. Oh, you guys got advantage again. Cool. All right, we've taken one of them out. We've disabled this guy. There's only one left. Third time, yeah, full out win. I mean, it just blew it out with a great roll. It's like, okay, great. So after basically 3 rounds and probably 4 or 5 total rolls, combat was over. Everything got summed up. We got great vivid description as I'm talking about how, you know, they take out the leg on the one troll and he's wounded and he goes to one knee. The other guy is, you know, getting to the edge of the cliff. We get to have all this dramatic stuff and my kid gets to feel like a badass. And that's all he wanted. He winds up with a great, great story. And it worked out so simply. We didn't bog it down with all the dice rolls. We didn't bog it down with all the modifiers and all the extra stuff. I just call out some modifiers. We roll a few dice, and boom, magic happens. And it was a lot of fun. So I will try not to talk anymore about my kids and gaming, my Goblins game specifically, until we've got a lot more into it. But, man, I'm having so much fun. I can't help it. I can't. I hope you guys are interested. But enough of that. Now it's time for the Science Corner.
Ooh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
And that music means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. Okay, here's where my train of thought went. This week is Neptune's closest pass to Earth, okay? And it was actually about a week ago, but still, for a good long month or so, you're going to have Neptune's closest pass to Earth, which means it is the absolute best possible time to go out and view Neptune yourself. If you know where to look, and, you know, if you've got a smartphone, just download the Google Sky Map, and it'll show you exactly where everything is. But the problem is you can't see Neptune with the naked eye, even on the best day. But a good pair of binoculars would do you, a telescope, certainly. You should get a good view of Neptune. The only trick is then you got to spend all the time figuring out which of those little dots of light is actually Neptune and not just a surrounding star. But you know what? I was going to take that, and I was going to build it into a big, long talk about Neptune and about Triton, because Neptune's largest moon, Triton, is pretty cool in its own right. And so I did a whole bunch of research on Neptune and Triton, and I found out that I'm just not that interested in Neptune and Triton. I mean, they're cool, and they've got some things about them there, but you know what? I wound up looking at, okay, but Triton is the 17th largest object in the solar system, and now I'm comparing moon sizes, and I'm back to looking at Io and Ganymede and Europa and the other moons that I know a lot better and I love so much. And I realized that my attention kept drifting away from them. So, sadly, you know, hey, if you're into Neptune, go out and take a look. There's a good shot for it. Go grab your binoculars and see if you can go see it. But instead, as I was looking at Jupiter, and I was looking at the satellites that orbit Jupiter, and then I was looking at the Trojan asteroids that trail around Jupiter in its L4 and L5 points, because remember I talked about Lagrange points last week? All right, well, that's the same kind of thing, and Lagrange 4 and Lagrange 5 are points on the orbit of a planet, or in this case Jupiter, but points on its orbit 60 degrees ahead and 60 degrees behind on the circle, ellipse, whatever it is that it travels. And those are also stable points where the motion and gravity of the sun and the planet balance out, or, you know, for that matter, the moon and the Earth, if you want to use the Lagrange points for the moon. And things balance there, and you can have stable stuff traveling around on those points as well. And Jupiter does. It has these Trojan asteroids that have been captured in these Lagrange points. All right, so then, again, Wikipedia hole. As I'm reading up on them and the Lagrange points again, the L5 Lagrange point, I noticed that it's got a link to the L5 Society, which I've never heard of. And after I looked at it, I'm surprised I've never heard of it. The L5 Society was a group started in, I don't remember, the 60s, right, when the space race was getting big and we were coming up with all this stuff, and it seemed like, you know, colonization of outer space was just moments away, just right around the corner we'd be putting colonies on the moon. Obviously, look, once we landed people there, well, setting up a hotel was just the next logical step, right? And the L5 Society was specifically a pro-space organization and pro-space colonization. This was their plan. And they called themselves the L5 Society because they thought at the time that locating at Lagrange 4 or Lagrange 5 in the Earth-Moon system would be the most stable place to put a permanent colony. You could put a space habitat at one of those points and basically have to use no fuel whatsoever to keep yourself in orbit. And that's a good thing. All right. Now, later we've come up with different orbits that also require very little energy but are a little safer, because as it turns out, if you're at Lagrange 4 and Lagrange 5, you are not protected by the Earth's magnetosphere for about a third of your time. All right, so a third of the time, you're having heavy-duty bombardment with cosmic rays and other radiation, and therefore it requires more shielding if you're going to be at one of those points. Although they've come up with some clever ideas for shielding as well. But anyway, I digress. The L5 Society wound up actually gaining some influence. They were the main opponents of the Moon Treaty, all right, in the, I don't remember, 80s, 83, 84, because we had had a space treaty, and the biggest part of the space treaty, it's this international treaty, tons of countries signed on it, and the biggest part of the space treaty is that we won't put weapons in space. That, you know, if we're going to explore space, then we're going to do it for the good of all mankind and for all sorts of noble causes, and we're not going to put weapons in space, and we're not going to threaten each other from space, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems like a good thing, sure. And then the Moon Treaty was the next logical step on this, to basically put the same kind of conditions on the moon. But the idea of it wound up basically prohibiting or making incredibly difficult the idea of putting colonies on the moon or putting colonies in space in general, because in order to do anything out there, because you weren't allowed to own territory on the moon, all right, so if you wanted to put out a space colony, if you wanted to put out a moon colony, well, then you needed to have, you know, you could own whatever particular vehicles you landed there, etc. But if you want to do more than that, it would require the permission of pretty much everybody who signed on to the Moon Treaty. It would require, and so the L5 Society saw that as a huge barrier, that basically if we get the Moon Treaty signed, it means that we're never going there. We're never going to have our permanent bases there. And for God's sake, we need to get off this planet, was their reasoning. And so their influence, actually, with the help of some politicians who were sympathetic to their cause, their influence kept us from signing the Moon Treaty. And on top of all of that, as it turns out now, none of the world's powers who are actually doing space exploration, who are actually actively involved in, you know, the major European countries, China, the U.S., the Soviet Union, well, Russia now, none of those countries ever signed the Moon Treaty in the end. And so really, the Moon Treaty is all well and good, and it's been signed onto it by a bunch of nations, but the nations who actually have the ability to do something about it, they didn't sign it. So guess what? Moon Treaty has absolutely no effect at the current moment. L5 Society wound up dying, well, not dying, it wound up stopping in 1984-ish, I think, because then they combined with another space advocacy group and they became the National Space Society, which again, pro-space, pro-NASA, pro-space exploration, pro-space colonization, and they are still active today. So if you're interested, if you are as excited as I am about the idea of us moving out of this planet and colonizing space eventually, go check out the National Space Society. They're interesting. But none of that is the really fascinating stuff. That's actually all history. I could have put that in the unnamed history segment. Better than that, though, is all of the plans they've come up with for how we're going to colonize space. All right, the actual ideas that serious scientists and sometimes government agencies have come up with to go, okay, if we did colonize space, how would we do it? All right, because me, all right, I've always in my head, my favorite space habitat has always been a giant wheel. Because you know you've got to have some kind of artificial gravity and you're going to have to do it by spinning the darn thing. And I've always just pictured a giant wheel that you've got your little science hub in the center where everything's weightless and you can do your manufacturing and your science and your other stuff. But you've got this hub at the center. And then out from that are these spokes, giant tower spokes, where gravity slowly increases. And I'm saying gravity in quotes. I know it's not real gravity. It's centrifugal force. But anyway, not the point. So you'd have spokes out from the center hub, and then you'd have this huge wheel on the outside, and the wheel would be where you have your actual living space and your exercise spaces and other great stuff. That would be your living area, is out there. And as I'm looking through all these proposed designs for habitats, not a single one of them is a wheel. Can you believe that? I apparently have been so wrong. There must be, and I couldn't come up with anything that gave me a good reason for it, but there's got to be a good engineering reason why wheels are just not practical in space. So instead, what they've got is cylinders. Cylinders are common, all right? So you get a cylinder, and quite literally, what is it, the O'Neill cylinder? I think that's the name of it. But the cylinder is 5 miles across, 20 miles long, all right? as living space for thousands of people. It is a city in the sky. And from there, they had habitats that were bolas. If you want a smaller habitat, smaller space station, a bola, where you basically, at your space habitat is on a big long cable, rope, chain, whatever you're going to do, and then there's some equivalent weight on the other side, possibly another habitat living unit, possibly just plain old weight. And then the two of them just spin around on their cable. All right, the cable keeps them together, and then they just spin, rotating around each other out in space. All right, wow, that was kind of cool. Spheres. They actually proposed spheres where the sphere would be a big old rotating sphere, and so around the equator of the sphere, that would be where the living area is. That's the equivalent of my wheel. But then you have the full sphere itself that slowly, as you go down the sides of it, you slowly get to the zero gravity areas towards the poles, as it were. But my favorite was the bolas then built into what they called beaded habitats. So you wind up having your bola, and then the bola possibly, it's tiny, but then as it expands and you add another unit to it, okay, now you have a triangle. So the three of them are connected together and rotating around on this triangle. Or then you add more nodes to it, beads. That's where the expression comes from. And now these connected sections move into what they call the bow tie configuration. And I didn't actually find a schematic of the bow tie configuration, but I thought that was kind of cool. I want to write a story in which we live on a habitat made up of all these individual units, all interconnected and rotating in a bow tie configuration. That seemed kind of cool to me. I'm guessing it's a couple of connected triangles. And then slowly, as you expand and you add more units, you now put them rotating so that the beads are all interconnected, and they form a giant cylinder that is essentially a net in the shape of a cylinder that rotates around, gives everyone their gravity, keeps them all interconnected, makes it easy to travel from one to the other. And the advantage to it, they said, is that, once you've got the beaded network of a habitat, it actually can grow organically, the way modern cities grow. All right, that you kind of start off small, and then as you expand and you need more facilities and more areas, you just add new beads to your network. All right, I thought that was kind of cool because, you know, you go with the cylinder or you go with the wheel. Well, you've now limited yourself to, once we've built it, this is how big we are. If we need to add to it, we're going to have to improvise, or we're going to have to rebuild something, or we're going to have to, where's the beaded network? It's just cool to me. And it wound up leading me to, obviously, things like the space elevator, and my Wikipedia adventure didn't stop there, obviously. Like, I went from the Neptune and into the Lagrange points, into L5 society, into space habitats, and then, okay, well, now how are we going to get stuff to and from our space habitats? So I started researching space elevators, the great quote about space elevators is that, everyone's going to be laughing about the concept of space elevators right up until the day they build one, because it's going to happen eventually. And for those of you who aren't familiar, space elevator, quite literally, a tower, maybe just a single, set of cables, maybe, but a tower that extends from Earth, right on the surface, at the equator, straight up into geosynchronous orbit. And if you want to get something into orbit, you hook it to the elevator and hit the button, and you ride up to the top. That's how a space elevator works. And it seems ludicrous, and yet, no, the technology's there. It's a very real thing, and I don't know, is it going to be 50 years from now? Is it going to be 100 years from now? I have no idea, but we'll be building them soon enough. It's going to happen. Mass drivers, I loved the idea, just the term. We want to launch things into space using mass drivers, all right? And I know I've seen them before, but I couldn't remember what a mass driver was. I just know that sounds really cool, because you're doing, it's a way to move stuff out of the gravity well without having to use propellant, all right? Without having to use rocket fuel and this kind of stuff. And essentially, it's a giant magnetic railgun. You put your ship into your giant magnetic railgun, and you essentially just fire it like a cannon shot into space. All right? That's cool. All right. Anyway, all of this keeps going, but the rest of it is even less coherent and organized than what I've got already. So you're going to hear from me on this again. But for now, good enough. Think about the space habitats. Think about living in a bola, in a beaded network of a space habitat. How cool is that? Okay. I'm getting close to my time here. In fact, I think I'm a little over. It does make any difference. R2 is banging on the door here, wanting to get in and do the Podomatic. But before that, real quick, something completely different.
And now for something completely different.
Yeah, just some stuff. I don't have a category for it yet. This is, real quick, I wanted to talk about spicy food. All right? I like spicy food, and every once in a while I like to do the pseudo-macho thing to prove how much hot stuff you can eat. You know, the Flaming Hot Cheetos, the hot peppers, the whatever it is. I don't do it often because it does hurt. Come on, people. All right. But Yancey brought some ghost pepper cheese to work, I don't know, 6 months ago. But there's a reason I'm thinking of it now. Anyway, he brought in ghost pepper cheese. And as we all know, ghost peppers are supposedly the hottest damn peppers out there, right? Okay. Yeah, you thought jalapeno was hot. You thought habanero was hot. You thought, no. Ghost peppers. These are the ones. These are the magic mouth killers. All right, here we go. And so he brought in cheese with ghost pepper in it. Well, I like cheese. I like peppers. All right, let's go ahead and try it out. And we each tried a piece there in the office. And I am telling you, eyes watering, burned like hell. The flavor was actually good. But, oh, my God, it was painful. It was uncomfortable. It's one of those where I'm eating something hot just to prove a point, not because I enjoy it, all right? I'm just proving how manly I am. But then Yancey said, well, here, take some with you. Take some home to your kids. This will be awesome. So I didn't get to give it to my kids until the next day. And so I give the two older boys each a slice of ghost pepper cheese, and they're like, well, aren't you going to have one? I'm like, all right, I'll take a piece too. I'm like, it's worth it to go through that pain and suffering again just to trick my kids into eating this stuff. And they know what they're getting into. But we all three tried it, and they did the exact same thing. I mean, the crying, the runny nose, the, oh, my God, give me some milk. All right. But I took it, and it's like, oh, you know what? Yeah, it burns a little bit, but that's not bad. It was actually enjoyable. I had built up just a little bit of a tolerance. So to test this out, the next 2 days in a row, I decided to try some ghost pepper cheese again. By the fourth day, I was like, oh, you know what? It doesn't even really hurt. It's not uncomfortable. I can actually enjoy the cheese for the flavor of it, for the flavor of the cheese, the flavor of the peppers, and actually enjoy it. And yeah, the burn's still there, but it wasn't bad. So apparently it's not even really a sign of manliness. It's just a sign of practice. Apparently you can get used to it, and it's not that big a deal. And now, of course, I've gone without any ghost pepper cheese for 6 months, and I'm sure if I had one now, I would be crying on the floor again. But it was kind of a cool experience. So the reason I'm thinking of ghost pepper cheese right now is because about a month ago this summer, I heard an NPR report, NPR as in National Public Radio, not Nerd Pride Radio. And on NPR, they had a story of some inner city YMCA program where the kids every summer produce a rap album. And this year, apparently, they've actually released the album. They've got it on iTunes. They've got it released. And some of it's not bad stuff. I mean, it's when you listen to it, it's clearly kids. It's, you know, 9, 10, 12-year-old kids. And so what are their songs about? Well, the only song they played for me on the radio, and it was kind of catchy, was called Hot Cheetos and Takis. Now, I know what Hot Cheetos are. I've never had Takis. But it's a rap song entirely about after-school snacks. That's all it is. Again, it's 10-year-olds, and it was cute. And Takis just stuck in my head. I'm like, you know, because they're talking about the red powder, which you get from hot, Flaming Hot Cheetos, but also apparently from the Takis. And I couldn't stop thinking about it because the tune would keep coming back to my head over and over. And I'm like, what in the hell are Takis? Obviously, it's some kind of hot snack food, but I don't know what it is. Well, sure enough, Walmart has Takis, and I'm looking at them. Must have been 2 weeks. I would go to Walmart, and there's the Takis. Didn't touch them. Finally, about a week or so ago, I'm like, all right, I can't take anymore. I got to buy a bag of Takis. Takis are essentially, and you probably all know this, and I'm the only one who was left in the dark, but Takis are essentially corn chips that are rolled up into a little cylinder, so it's a little stick of a rolled-up corn chip, and then covered with some kind of flaming hot powder. I found out later that they actually come in several flavors, but the only flavor that Walmart carried when I was there was Fuego. So, obviously very hot. And I got home, and they're really good. Oh, man, I like them. And again, one of those things, I had my bag of Takis, take them to work. I've been on a diet, so I can't have I can't sit down and eat the whole bag. But Takis are exactly 10 calories a piece, so every day at work I can have five of them. All right, or if I'm really wanting to splurge on the snack, all right, I'll have 10. All right, so I just eat a few of them every day, and again, the hot, it's kind of hot the first time, but by the end of the week, I've been going through this bag all week long, and it's they're just Takis, and they taste damn good. Really enjoy that. Then yesterday, Yancey comes to work with fudge that he bought while he was on vacation. And so he cuts me off a piece of fudge, and he says, here, try this. And I tasted it, and it was darn good fudge. I mean, just great, great flavor. And then after I get done, I'm like, what is that tingling? And as I'm sitting there just obviously thinking to myself, Yancey goes, yeah, you feel a kick now, don't you? I'm like, yeah, what is that? He goes, jalapenos. I'm baffled. Because, all right, A, who puts jalapenos in fudge? Are you kidding? All right. But then, number two is, that's really good. Oh, man, that was awesome. Because it wasn't, when I say, look, it was a little tingle, it was a little kick. All right. It was not, it didn't burn. It wasn't uncomfortable. I could have gone through, if I was willing to gorge myself, I could have gone through the entire damn bag of fudge. And, wouldn't have been burning, wouldn't have been hurting. But enough of a kick. And I'm like, wow, that's really effective. I dig that. So there you go. That's my hot food experiences over the last few months. Which brings me to something I haven't done in a long time. It's the word of the week. Yeah, holy cow. I actually came up with a good word for this week. As I was doing my research on the underbelly of Rome and all this, they got to the catacombs under Rome and said it was a softer stone that was easy to dig through, made really good for, very poor, poor people who needed a place to bury their dead. And the type of stone it was is tough. T-U-F-F, tough. That's my word. All right. And it comes from, I think, the Italian tufo, T-U-F-O. And tough is essentially, it's a geological term, and it is stone that is formed out of compressed volcanic ash. So it's actually fairly light and porous enough that it makes for a soft stone. And the best part about it, all right, is as I'm reading through the article on tuff, there's actually lots of different types of tuff. There's basaltic tuff, and there's andesitic tuff, and there are tons of others. But my absolute favorite, I don't even know why it's any different from any of the others, but ultramafic tuff. I think that's awesome. I would love to be described as ultramafic tuff. That'd be pretty cool. All right, anyway, that's my word of the week. And how would you feel about a badass movie quote of the week? Yeah. All right. This is two dudes, all right, Charlie and Brett. All right. Charlie starts off. A number of times, the only thing that kept me out of a satin box was I could size up the other guy maybe half a second quicker than he could me. Brett replies, what the f*** are you talking about? You're taped to a chair. Charlie says, I'll admit, I'm out of practice. That is Christopher Walken playing Charlie Barrett, taped to the chair, and Jay Moore as Brett Campbell, his foil, in the movie Suicide Kings. And the reason I pulled up that quote, and there's actually a ton of great quotes from Suicide Kings. I almost did actually an entire rant by Dennis Leary, and I may do that one coming up. But for this one, I wanted to do Walken and Jay Moore, because that is the key to this movie, is that Christopher Walken is taped to a chair for like 80 or 90% of this movie. And Christopher Walken owns this movie. He is acting from a chair, taped to a chair. He doesn't have his hands. He doesn't have anything. All he's got is his voice and his face, and he kills it. You have not seen a performance like this in your life. It is wonderful. The movie itself, a little mediocre. I really enjoy it. I love it. I've seen it a bunch of times. But Walken, that's why you want to watch this film, is you want to see Walken, because it's just great. All right, it's a kidnapping mystery kind of thing, and it's got criminals and gangsters, and it's got Walken. And Walken, even taped to a chair, Walken is the scariest badass ever. I love this film. which means all that can be left is the Pod-O-Matic! Oh, hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Then send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, screw the email, send it to me in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to our Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And this first number from Mr. R2 is 97. 97 comes from, Dire Cat. This is cool. Hi, Dire Cat. Welcome to the show. Dire Cat just signed up for the forums, actually, June, I think, a couple months ago. But I have another podcast. Well, I wasn't doing podcasts at the time. So thank you for showing up. Dude, I hope you're still listening. And it's not like we're running short on Pod-O-Matic entries at the moment, because I'm actually just over 200 and something here. Anyway, I had gotten down to just under 200, and suddenly this message comes from Dire Cat, and Dire Cat has given me 30 new entries for the Pod-O-Matic. He now dominates. So thank you. Thank you, Dire Cat. I hope we see a lot more of yours. Well, hold on. Let's see what kind of quality you've given this first. Dire Cat says, if the pointer finger of your right hand suddenly turned into a gun and fired a shot right now, what of your surroundings would be destroyed? That is an awesome question. And as it turns out, my hand is resting on the table by my microphone here. And so if my index finger on that hand were to fire, it would hit, it would go under the microphone, it would go through the dining table. I might wind up shattering my own knee at this moment. And then it would pass through the floor. I'm assuming I've got a very high-powered rifle in my finger. It would shatter my knee, pass through the floor, and it would wind up in Gygax's bedroom, I believe. Ooh, it would be a close thing. You might hit Gygax's bed or else just the big throw rug next to his bed. I'm not sure which one. So there you go. Good question, Dire Cat. Number four from, Serious Paul. Did you know there were once 500 nations of Indian tribes? What? No, Paul, I actually did not know that number. I knew there were a lot. I did not know the number. I actually just recently learned that the main reason that the Europeans were able to so easily overcome the Native Americans, and I say easily as a relative term. I mean, we've always attributed it to our superiority technologically, and we would assume, being the egomaniacs that we are, that also culturally, and probably we had God on our side, and who knows what else. All right, but leaving all of our Eurocentrism aside, it's been taught to me, and I've just always believed this, just because we were just superior technologically. We had the guns and the steel, and they didn't. And so we wound up wiping them out ultimately. And it took us a few hundred years, but we got there. And as it turns out, a more important factor would be that our diseases wiped them out before we even really got started on conquering them. I mean, yes, we talk about how vulnerable they are to, you know, smallpox and other European diseases, because, you know, we were living in filthy, stinky squalor in the huge cities of Europe, and we'd gone through the plagues, and we'd built up our immunities, whereas they hadn't, and they just didn't have the defenses against our European diseases. Well, what they're saying is that, yeah, during that first couple hundred years, you know, white people started hitting the shores. We built our little colonies, and then we failed, and then we came again, and then we failed again. But we brought over enough diseases at that time that all the while that we're just trying to get a toehold on the coast. We're just trying not to die in the winter. Whole time that we're going through that, our diseases from our earliest settlers were spreading like friggin' wildfire across the entire continent and wiped out quite literally 90% or better of the Native American population. All right, so we come out here, and, you know, and now the land has had time to heal a little bit, and, Some of their settlements have been completely covered over and whatever else. So, you know, we get out there a couple hundred years later, and we're looking at these huge, wide-open, sparsely populated areas and thinking that these Indians are just a knockover, pushover. That's the word I was looking for. And we wind up plowing through them. Imagine if there were 10 times as many of them. Just imagine for a minute if they had had some resistance to European disease. And imagine if there were 10 times as many Native Americans. How quickly would we have plowed our way through them then? All right. We may still have won, you know, right? But you know, the handful of colonists we were bringing over would not have been a match for quite, you know, 50 million or 100 million Native Americans. Right? It would have taken us a lot longer, and we might have been a little more willing to talk about peace and to be a little more fair on our treaties if they had that kind of backing behind them. So very, very interesting. I've gone completely off your question, but I'm not surprised at all, Paul, that there were that many Indian tribes because damn, there were a lot of them, and we kind of killed them. Number 31. This is also from Serious Paul. All right, Paul. You're not going to let Dire Cat stand in your way, are you? Paul says, I'm pretty sure I could beat you in a sword fight. I take fencing classes. I know I could beat my dad if he had a sword made of cheese. Okay. Well, since there's no question in there, thanks, Paul. Number 4 again. Come on, you can do better than that, R2. Number 25. This one's from Akiva. We haven't heard from Akiva in a while. Cool. Akiva says, given that we all know that Paul McCartney died back in the 60s, despite the band's pathetic attempts to cover it up, who the blank, he's got the asterisks here, is this clown claiming to be Paul McCartney? Oh, okay. Have you seen pictures of quote-unquote Paul McCartney lately? Yeah, apparently it's like an 85-year-old lady. Ugh. Yeah, this imitation Paul is not looking good as he's getting older. Maybe he was convincing when they first picked him, but now the years have not been kind to this doppelganger. And, yeah, 85-year-old woman, I'm pretty sure. Number 63, ooh, from the Rave Master. Rave Master says, do you have a type of coin that is your favorite? And then in parentheses, it could be either because of its monetary denomination, ease of use, or just because it's cool, etc. All right. Yes, I do have a favorite coin. And my favorite coin is the gold dollar. Only because I still hold out hope. Go back a couple dozen episodes and listen to my rant about American money. But I still hold out hope that someday we will get rid of pennies, we will get rid of nickels, the dime will be our lowest denomination of coin, and the gold dollar will replace the dollar bill, which we will stop printing and wasting money on. That is my dream, and I love gold dollars because of that. It's kind of hard to hold on to the dream for, you know, this many years, decades even, because the U.S. government is not doing anything to make this happen. They're clearly not with me, and so therefore... Yeah, I'm sure it would be un-American to get rid of pennies. I'm sure that's it. People don't want to get ripped off, again in quotes. But I love the gold dollar. I used to make a habit of any time I had pocket change, which I don't carry pocket change very often. Usually I just use my debit card for everything. But if I had to carry money, I tried to make a point to always carry it in gold dollars and then spend them. And everywhere you go to spend your gold dollar, and people are just always amazed. And of course, you know the end result is you're going to spend a gold dollar at the gas station. Before the end of the day, one of the employees there is going to put a dollar into the register, take out your gold dollar, and then secret it away and hide it forever to save it, and then it's out of circulation again. And it didn't do me any damn bit of good, but I kept trying. So that's my favorite coin. 53. This one from Dire Cat again. Dude, see, I told you this guy's going to dominate. He says, in a zombie apocalypse, do you choose chainsaw, shotgun, or shrink ray? Oh my god, that's the best question ever! Shrink ray, dude! Oh my god, that's awesome! Because, alright, look, chainsaw and shotgun have the inherent fault that they're going to run out. You're going to run out of shells. You're going to run out of gas. Eventually, they're going to become just useless lumps in your hand. You'd be better off with a crowbar or a baseball bat or something built to be a melee weapon. But if you're giving me a choice of shrink ray, now, I know what you're saying, Mike, but won't the shrink ray eventually have its batteries die on you? Well, obviously no, all right, because it's a shrink ray. It's operated by a mini fusion pile. That sucker is good for, 13 years minimum? All right, so I'm probably getting 20 years of life out of my shrink ray. And it's a shrink ray. What better way? Oh, my God. If you could just shrink the zombies? I smell a movie in this. All right? Coalition of mad scientists fending off their own zombie creations using shrink rays? I am set for this. I don't even have to describe it. You can already imagine. Shrink ray, stomp, zombie gone. That's awesome. I could do that for hours. And R2 gives us a 78. 78 comes from Talvin. Talvin says, what is your favorite old school first edition D&D adventure module and why? Well, this is an easy one. It would be Keep on the Borderlands because it was the only one I had. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I didn't use a lot of modules as a kid. I just didn't. I did once Dragon Magazine started publishing Dungeon, and Dungeon was giving you free adventures every month or every couple of months, however they worked it. Loved Dungeon. And I used theirs, and I used the adventures that would come out of Dragon from time to time. But I didn't purchase the modules. I just never did. I don't know why. Weird, huh? 57. 57 comes from, Mr. Brasky. I love you, Brasky. Brasky says, can you explain the appeal to shows with laugh tracks to them? I'm trying to watch How I Met Your Mother, and I've previously tried watching The Big Bang Theory, and I don't like them. It may be that they're not funny, or it may be that the laugh tracks are terrible, but I can't separate the two issues. Is this just me? Okay. I don't notice laugh tracks. I really don't, and I probably should. But and I also don't notice the absence of laugh tracks either. So I'm just inured to them, I guess. But I'm going to make a guess that it's a combination of things. One, once you've gotten to where you're noticing laugh tracks, and now because of this question, I'm sure I'm going to, I don't think they're going to be able to help but annoy you once you start noticing them. So that's already going to diminish your enjoyment of something because you're going to notice the laugh track. See, I always just assumed that it was filmed in front of a live studio audience, but maybe that's just because Carla's voice on Cheers, which is, by the way, whenever I say filmed in front of a live studio audience, I always hear Carla's voice from Cheers saying it. Maybe I've just become accustomed to the idea that that's actually real people laughing, even when it's not. But yeah, now I'm going to start noticing the laughter, and it's going to start bothering me. I'm just sure of it. But also, I think it's the style of show. The kind of show that uses a laugh track is, it's typically a sitcom, and it's typically, you're just not a fan of sitcoms, dude. It is, and I understand that there are some sitcom-style shows that you have enjoyed, but I wouldn't even make them sitcoms. I would make them like Better Off Ted. But Better Off Ted also didn't have a laugh track, but at least I don't think it did. See, that's the thing I don't notice. I don't remember, but I don't think it did. Or Arrested Development, but these are ones that go for a completely different style of humor. They're not fishing for the same traditional humor style that you would get out of a sitcom. And I think more than the laugh track, I think it's just you don't care for that style of show. Situation comedy, quite literally, we come up with a bizarre cast of characters, and then we create weird situations, and then each one reacts in their one-dimensional way to whatever that situation happens to be. And it's a tried-and-true formula, and it makes them a lot of money, but I understand your disillusionment with it. I still enjoy some of those shows, but not nearly as many as I used to. It's very hard for me to start enjoying a new sitcom. So I get where you're coming from, and I think it's more the style of the show than it is the laugh track itself. I think the two just happen to correlate. They go together a lot because they think they need it. 86. Hey, Ravemaster gets another one. Ravemaster says, Have you ever heard of or played the card game Munchkin or Flux? Well, have I? Well, in fact, I think I've even talked about both of these on the podcast at some point, but of course I have. I love, love Munchkin and Flux immensely, all right? And Munchkin more so. Here's the deal. I've got too many Munchkin cards. I've stopped buying expansions because I have just too damn many cards, and I'm thinking of weeding out some of them. But it's still, when we play Munchkin, we still play a pretty reasonable game. It doesn't take too long. All right, so we're still, but you can see where the expansions have kind of pushed out how long each game takes just a little bit. But so far, it's manageable, and I think I'm going to keep it right there. But the thing I love best about Munchkin is I have never introduced a person to Munchkin and had them not like it. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're into D&D or not. Doesn't matter if you know the tropes. It doesn't matter if Munchkin's just a fun game all by itself. And every single person, and I've introduced 7-year-olds to it. Well, my own kids I introduced even younger than that, but other people's kids at 7 or 8. All right, all the way up to grown people, middle-aged people, doesn't make any difference. Every single person I've had play Munchkin with me loves the game. And in fact, the only thing that keeps us from playing it more often with other people, well, one, opportunity, but two, is because it is a little time-consuming. Maybe I will weed out my cards. Maybe I will take it down to something closer to the original deck with maybe just an expansion or two in it. But anyway, that's beside the point. Love Munchkin. And I also really love Flux. I own Flux and I own Zombie Flux, and I greatly enjoy both of them, and highly recommend to anybody. Go out and try Flux. Great, great system. And that one also, it takes a little longer for people to get used to it because Flux has the possibility of your first game or two being A, really, really random, and B, ending too quickly. That, you know, it's like, okay, we've handed out our cards, we're going around, and someone hits the win condition, like, within the first 10 minutes, and everyone else at the table, because, you know, you're playing with 5 or 6 people, everyone else at the table is like, well, that was pointless, all right? And it usually takes 2-3 games for someone to really settle into Flux and go, oh, I get it. Because it's those games where it goes on just a little bit longer. Not too long, but it goes on just a little bit longer. And you've got lots of cards out there. And you've had a ton of rules, but now you've actually been able to play strategically and weed out some of the rules and kind of guide things your own way. And it's always a matter. It's never a matter of meeting the win conditions. It's always a matter of changing the win conditions to match what you already have. And once people start getting that, they start to really enjoy Flux. But it takes just a little bit longer sometimes. Some people get it immediately. They just have a good game. Things go well. But I've had a couple of cases where the first game or two, it's like you can see that they're not really getting it, and you have to kind of push them into that next game, and then suddenly it all clicks for them. And now you love it. Munchkin never had that problem. Munchkin, first time out of the gate, everybody loves Munchkin. It's magic. No, wait, no. It's not magic, because Magic is a card game I've never played, but I've heard that it's good. But magical. Maybe that's what I should say. Number 12. 12 is from my old friend Billy Bob. Billy Bob says, do you cook? And what's the best dish you make? Well, actually, I love to cook. In fact, one of my kids was just asking me last night, Dad, what's the first thing you ever cooked? Because he was, my kids will, if I'm in the kitchen, they like to come in and help. If Nadia's in the kitchen, they like to go help her. They just like being in there. They love cooking. It's great family time. They love to help out. And one of my kids asked me last night, Dad, what's the first thing you ever cooked? What's the first meal you ever made? And I'm like, oh, meal. All right, my first meal would be macaroni and cheese. Because I can remember cooking when I was little. All right, I remember when we got a microwave, and I was only 7 when we got a microwave, I remember being thrilled to death that we had this microwave because my mom told me that I could cook a hot dog in it in under a minute. You're kidding with me. Because up until that point, anytime I wanted hot dogs, I would get out a pot of water. I would boil water on the stove, drop my hot dogs in for the right amount of time. I would boil my hot dogs to cook them every time I wanted a damn hot dog, which was fairly often, really. And obviously, I was making my own breakfast cereal. You know, if I was hungry and wanted cereal, I could make a bowl of cereal. And I was also making my own macaroni and cheese by the time I was 7, too. So, again, you know, boiling water, strainer, the whole bit. And I've always enjoyed cooking. And I've been doing it for a long time. My kids seem to enjoy the exact same sort of thing. And I'm not saying I'm any kind of gourmet chef. I don't do anything fancy. I don't do anything big. You know, it's mostly, you know, I can do spaghetti and I can do casseroles and I can do, you know, I can grill stuff and whatever. But I just enjoy doing it. I really like it. Whole family does. But what is the best thing that I cook? There's a lot of tasty things that I make. But I would say my favorite meal that I make is, we call it Italian chicken, and the recipe came off of the back of a Hungry Jack box, I think. But you get Hungry Jack mashed potatoes, or mashed potato buds, or whatever they call them, but the Hungry Jack instant potato thing, all right? And then you're supposed to do it with chicken drumsticks, but we found we just like doing it with just plain old chicken strips. You just slice up chicken breasts to get some nice chicken strips. And you wind up, you roll them in flour, and then after the flour, you dip them in, it's light Italian. You dip it in light Italian dressing, all right? And now once it's coated in light Italian dressing, you throw your chicken strip into this mixture of the Hungry Jack potatoes, the instant potatoes, so it's dry powdery stuff. It's mixed Hungry Jack potatoes, Parmesan cheese, parsley, and then like garlic salt and some other spices in there. And that becomes your coating, all right? And then once you get your whole thing of chicken strips done up, you throw them all in a pan, you bake them for however much time, and when it's done, you have these coated, it's not quite crispy, but you have these breaded, coated chicken strips with this tangy, tangy dressing flavor on the inside, and they're just awesome, and really low calorie, surprisingly low calorie. So we like it as a diet food. And it's probably my favorite because it's the most complicated thing I make. I mean, to actually go through that many steps of, I mean, I have to break out how many dishes and go through that many steps of, okay, cut up chicken, dip chicken in flour, dip chicken in dressing, dip chicken in coating mixture, throw it on a pan, off we go. That's a lot of work for me. I mean, I'm really, I once saw the Eaten Out of a Can cookbook. It's like a man cookbook thing at the bookstore where basically everything is a dump casserole. Everything is, you open up these cans, you dump them all in, mix them, top them, throw them in the oven, done. All right, that's the kind of cooking I can do. I can brown hamburger, mix it with stuff, top it with cheese, and throw it in the oven. All right, that's easy stuff for me. But this one took a little bit more work, and I really dig it. So anyway, that's my Italian chicken. 88 comes from Zimney Pot. And Zimney always asks the hard questions. If you could start your own religion, what would it be like? All right. If I could start my own religion, that's a tough question. My religion would be about the basic tenets of, I mean, look, if you're going to build any religion, you have to start with do unto others, obviously. I mean, that's the supposedly the heart of every religion is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Treat others as you would yourself. That's the first, all right? Or to condense it down even further, love everybody. Love everybody unconditionally. Do it. All right, so there's step one. But you know what? I would also build more into it of communication and honesty and truth. And in fact, I actually built a Star Wars character for the Star Wars role-playing game, and she was a young Jedi student, not even Jedi student, but Force-sensitive, and I designed an entire religion for her, some obscure religion, but it tied into her use of the Force and blah, blah, blah. And it was actually built on some of those basic tenets. I had to design a religion for her, and I wanted it to be something that I could role play really well, something that I could, I felt I could get a good grasp on. So I took a lot of that, the bit about intellectual honesty and truth. And it included a lot about, exploration and curiosity and preserving that which is good and truthful. And anyway, it was interesting. I don't have a whole lot of detail on it, but it would probably be something like that. But you know what? I don't think I would ever start a religion because Well, there's already plenty of them out there to choose from, and I don't see, unless I'm going to go for the whole profit motive, and do something like Scientology, and I don't see the value in creating a new religion. Again, I can't even imagine going into it for the profit motive. Obviously, it works, and certainly you could do that, but I don't feel like being a cult leader. I don't feel like making money off of people's beliefs. That's not my deal. So anyway, but good question. Number 42 from Stan. Stan says, what biggest thing pulls you out of immersion in a role-playing game? The biggest thing is probably the dick jokes. All right. And it's a tough one, but it's the side jokes that, and usually dick jokes, inappropriate, sexual humor, this kind of stuff. And I game a lot with teenage boys. And so therefore you get a lot of that kind of conversation. And here's the thing is that dick jokes are an integral part of role-playing games. And when I say dick jokes, again, I don't mean it's all about dicks. I mean, it's all the, your mother jokes and, ooh, that's what she said. And, you know, twisted puns. Oh my God, you said duty. It's all that kind of stuff. It's all that kind of juvenile humor. And it's just always been a part of gaming for me that everyone makes jokes like that. You're having a good time with friends, and the kind of friends I have all make jokes like that on a regular basis. And it's just a matter of letting it happen at the table. I mean, because people are going to talk, people are going to make jokes, they're going to make side comments, you know. Who wouldn't it be funny if I did this? And yet, the problem is they do the joke, they get a laugh, they get some attention for it, and now they're encouraged to do it more. And you want to let them have that little outlet, but you also, you know, every game session has at least one point where it builds up and it becomes just a little bit too much. And it's like, all right, dudes, seriously, we got to scale it back. If you guys aren't going to pay attention, there's no point in even playing. All right. That's the one that bugs me the most. And again, it's a hard thing because to my mind, you have to let that happen. If you're going to absolutely eliminate side talk, if you're going to eliminate out of character talk, that would not be as much fun for me, I don't think. So some of it has to happen, but you got to keep a lid on it. You got to learn to moderate. It's like how hard it is to diet, because you still got to eat. You got to have some food. You just can't have too much. You know what I mean? Number 87. 87 from Daz. Daz says, no remake of Daredevil? What's up with that? I've never seen the original Daredevil, or I don't even know if it's the original. I've never seen the Ben Affleck Daredevil. And why is there no remake? Well, Daredevil's not that great a hero. Sorry, man. Apparently, Marvel has been really busy with the Spider-Man franchise, the X-Men franchise, and now the Avengers franchise. And they've got some huge moneymakers there. There's no one other than you, apparently. There's no one clamoring for a good Daredevil movie. All right. And in fact, there was no one clamoring for an Iron Man movie either. Iron Man's in the same kind of boat. He's cool if you know him and if you've followed him, if you're one of his fans. Daredevil can be cool, but he doesn't have the cult file. He doesn't have the people begging for it. And Iron Man was the same way. No one was begging for an Iron Man movie, but they needed to make Iron Man to get to Avengers, ultimately. And then once they got him out there, oh man, Iron Man kicks ass. Holy crap! And Iron Man came out to be one of the best superhero movies ever. And certainly Daredevil could have that, but he's a lone wolf. We don't need him for some other franchise. If someone was to make a Daredevil movie, it would be because they think they can make a lot of money off of a Daredevil movie. And right now, there's no one thinking they can make a lot of money off of a Daredevil movie. All right, no matter how good it is, not going to happen. So maybe someday. Maybe someday I'll get my Green Arrow movie, you know? Although Green Arrow's getting his own TV show or has his own TV show? Holy crap, who knew? 15 from Jeff Hawes. Hi, Jeff. Your most recent nightmare. If it doesn't involve me, I'm quitting the site, and I mean it this time. All right. My nightmares, and when I mean nightmare, I have bad dreams, or I have dreams that feature horror elements, or I have, you know, there's all sorts of them, but no, for me, a true nightmare is one where you wake up You have to take a few seconds to sort out reality from fantasy. You have to take a moment, as you lay in bed, you have to take a moment to reassure yourself that it was just a dream. To tell yourself it really, just a dream, it's okay, nothing bad's going to happen, I'm safe because I'm in my bed, okay, good, they're not real, all right, good. And then you're afraid to fall asleep again because it'll start again. And now, for me, I always wake up from a nightmare, and then I immediately go back to sleep because, whatever, okay, nightmare's done, I know I'm safe, good, go back to sleep. And I immediately go right back into the same dream, and then the second time I wake up, then suddenly, oh God, okay, now I can't go back to sleep. I need to wake up. I need to be awake for a good 20 minutes to distract my mind so that when I go back to sleep, all right, when you're afraid to go back to sleep, that's a nightmare. That's a good one, all right? And my nightmares almost always involve vampires that act a lot like zombies. Sometimes it's just straight up zombies, but it's usually vampires. At least in the dream, I know they're vampires, but they're easily defeated like zombies, but there's always so many of them, and you just never know what's around the corner, and they drive me crazy. And worst of all, every single one of them, every single time, has Jeff Hawes's face. 85 is from McDiddles. Hey, McDiddles, I don't even know if you listen anymore. All right, but I've still got your questions, dude. What? Oh man, this is an old one. What is your opinion on the new Hershey's Air Delight? Alternately, what is your favorite candy bar? All right, I've never tried a Hershey's Air Delight, but my take on it is they take their mediocre chocolate and add air to it so they can sell you less chocolate for the same price. That's my opinion of it. I've never tasted it. I don't know. It could be very good. What's your favorite candy bar? Milky Way. It's always been Milky Way. Actually, technically, I like Snickers better now. As I've gotten older, I've realized I really like the peanuts in my candy bar. But while I would prefer a Snickers, there's a soft spot in my heart for the Milky Way. It was always my candy bar as a kid. Love the Milky Way. This is from Scree. Scree says, what would you think of this idea for a story writing thing I'm thinking about? It is literally punctuation, a colon. It is not, he doesn't write the word colon because that, anyway, I don't know what's wrong with you people. Stop it. Here's his idea. Werewolf Pirates, the True Sea Dogs. Oh man, I'm already loving it. Of course, when I say werewolves, I mean the ones that change at will and can somewhat control themselves. Oh, okay, now I'm less interested once you do that. Here's the deal. Werewolves and pirates are both a good idea. Put them together and make some werewolf pirates. I am completely on board. And then when you call the movie Sea Dogs, just like when they made the movie Dog Soldiers, oh, dude, I will watch it just for that title. It could be a complete crap movie. I will still watch it. This is a great story. Okay, now you're talking about writing a story, not about a movie, but this is where my head goes. I think this is a brilliant idea. All right. Now, they can change at will and can somewhat control themselves. All right. Once you say somewhat control themselves, all right, I'm more on board. Because werewolves, to be cool in my opinion, always have to be somewhat out of control. Always have to be on edge, as if whenever the tension starts to mount, at any moment, boom, they could go over. All right. Any moment, they're wolfing out and tearing stuff up. And when they're in wolf form, or even the wolf-man hybrid form, they get that berserker rage going. They get the bloodlust, all right? That, for me, that's part of being a werewolf. And as werewolf pirates, oh, man. And I'm assuming you're talking about classical, romanticized pirates, not modern-day Somali pirates, although that would be a cool movie too. But the idea of having werewolves, I mean, like I say, I'm thinking of playing it out as straight horror. I mean, it's got to be a horror movie or a horror story where these have got to be scary things, and they're out there being pirates and doing piratey things, except, you know, they don't take hostages. They kill and eat. They tear stuff up. Man, this is just a great idea. Yeah, no, I like it. Dude, go with that. bam. I don't know what time it is for you guys, but I'm already showing an hour and a half here. So we're going to have to make this one our last one. This is number 18 from Sirius Paul. Sirius Paul says, why does the computer care about me, citizen? Well, because the computer was designed with the sole purpose of preserving human life, obviously. The citizen cares about, or the computer cares about all of its citizens. Right? It loves each and every one of us, including you, all right, and wants only what's best for you. The computer is there to protect you, to serve you, to love you. Now, I will take a note in your written question here. I note that for some reason you didn't capitalize the word computer, which is a serious lack of respect, bordering, one would say, on traitorous. I don't know how much time you spend with your commie friends. Okay, I don't know exactly what your mutant abilities are, but this lowercase c here has cause for concern with me. Just all I'm saying is, stay where you are. Yet no, the door's locked. You can just wait there. I'm going to make a report. I'm sure you're a cool dude. All right, I'm good with you, Paul. But just to be on the safe side, I'm going to make a report. I'll let them check it out, and they'll decide. So look, someone's going to come along. They'll talk to you. Maybe you'll get a chance to talk to the computer yourself. You can explain it, okay? Anyway, I'll be back. Thanks.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. This week's theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. Our bumper music comes from Sam Cooke's Wonderful World, Weezer's In the Garage, and William Shatner doing a cover of She Blinded Me with Science. All these songs are available on iTunes. They're all wonderful. I love them. I wouldn't put them in my podcast if I didn't love them. Go check them out. Go buy them. Go enjoy them. All right, if you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write a nice review. Or if you want to contact me, you could always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com or even check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But really, none of that's important. To be totally honest, the best way to talk to me is to come sign up for our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. You'll sign up, you'll send me a message, we'll hang out together, we'll be best buds, we'll have fun. Dude, my son convinced me that I had to watch Under the Red Hood, the Batman animated movie. He had the DVD, told me I had to see it. It was the best Batman animated movie he'd seen. He said it was one of the best Batman movies ever. So I sat down and watched him. And I've been a little bit hesitant, all right, because I've heard that the Justice League animated movies, the Justice League animated show, the Batman animated movies, the Batman Superman, that really DC has been doing awesome stuff with their straight to DVD superhero movies. I've heard raves about them. Never have checked them out. Everyone keeps telling me I need to, and I just haven't done it. And so I wound up watching Under the Red Hood because he was so insistent about it. And I have got to tell you, he was not kidding. I loved Under the Red Hood. Spectacular. I don't want to give anything away. I always say that, and I probably always give stuff away anyway, but it was really good. It was dark. It was incredibly violent, incredibly bloody. People died a lot in this movie. It had John DiMaggio as the Joker, which he did really well, but I gotta warn you, it's kind of hard not to hear Bender's voice when you're hearing Joker talk. But I got past that. And it had Neil Patrick Harris, whom I love, playing Nightwing. So Robin has graduated to Nightwing in this particular movie. And it was just wonderful. absolutely wonderful. And I had the mystery of it figured out early on, and I think you're supposed to. I mean, I think you're supposed to figure it out before Batman and Robin finally, well, Batman and Nightwing finally put it together. But it was really well played. And even knowing what it was going to turn out to be, that wasn't the point. The point was, how do you deal with it once you find out? And the character interaction and the moral of it, and it was really good. Really good. I highly recommend Batman Under the Red Hood. If you got a chance to watch it, you should. This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. This week's theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. Our bumper music was from... damn it, I suck at this.